I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everybody. Today, my guest is Meredith Gould, and she is a prolific author. We'll be discussing her book, Deliberate Acts of Kindness, A Field Guide to Service as a Spiritual Practice. Meredith is an author of many books, and she has her PhD in sociology. She also does a lot of help with ministries, helping them with digital tools for communication. She helps writers with editing and coming up with ideas for pitching. And well, we can get into some of those things that you do, Meredith, but thank you so much for being my guest today.
Well, thank you. It's a good way to start the week or restart the week because I wasn't real thrilled with yesterday. So here we are.
Yeah. What are some of the things you do day to day? Because I didn't even know how to introduce you really because you have such a cornucopia of talents and skills.
Oh, yeah, that's a nice way of putting it, cornucopia. Yeah, my mother used to say, can't you decide on something? yeah, I do a lot of different things because I've lived a big chunk of time and I've had a whole bunch of careers. But the interesting thing is they all seem to come together in a piece, kind of a crazy quilt in a way. My doctorate is in sociology, and I tell people that I have an advanced degree in peeping through the keyhole of life, putting people into categories and then judging them. I mean, I'm allowed to do that because I'm a sociologist. So I was a college professor for a decade, and I've worked in state government as with a public information campaign, and I've worked in an ad agency and a PR firm, and then as a marketing communications consultant. And then I fell in love with digital kind of at the turn of the century and work with churches on digital communications and digital ministry. Currently, I'm very keen on digital activism, helping people not sound like not undermining themselves or their causes when they get online. And so, you know, the theme through the whole thing is communications, and another theme is writing. And I guess I should add artwork because I started out as an artist, actually. So I have a lot of training in graphic design and illustration, again, in the world before there were computers, so I used to do that by hand. So what's happened is all that has come together. I'm not even mentioning my weird spiritual life, but all that has come together so that I can really work with people on a variety, in a variety of ways. And I don't like getting bored. So I take advantage of having a cornucopia of interests and skills to offer that to people.
Mm. It does seem like your work really does center around people and relating. And a lot of your books are spiritually centered or work right. as field guides. And maybe you can talk just at least a little bit briefly about some of your own spiritual journey. I know that's going to be like, that could be its own episode.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe I should say it this way, is this book is about spiritual service and or service as a spiritual practice. And correct. In your own life, how is that related to your spiritual journey?
Well, it's what I tell people, and you know, listeners can go Google me and they can get the full brunt of the full enjoyment of seeing all the different things. But I tell people I have a multiple spirituality disorder because I was raised in one religious tradition. I was raised Jewish, so I used to say I'm a Jew by identity. Well, I still say I'm a Jew by identity, a Christian by faith, and a yogini by practice. Now, I used to say that. Today, I don't know. Jew by identity. Today's the Feast of St. Benedict, so I'm very Benedictine today. And I haven't done yoga in a while, but, you know, yoga off the mat. So, what can I say? In terms of the service, with this particular book, Service as a Spiritual Practice, I realize that my understanding, I mean, at the core of spirituality, it's very difficult to define what do we mean when we say somebody is spiritual or something is spiritual or we're spiritual but not religious. What is spiritual really? What does that word encode? And I even have difficulty defining it. But basically what it means is having a spiritual awareness is the awareness that there is first that all beings, all things are connected, and that there's something greater than ourselves at play in the world. So that's really the essence. I mean, that boils it down a lot, and I can just hear a whole bunch of spiritual teachers, you know, banging their heads against some kind of, you know, numinous wall and frustration. But I mean, that's really it. I mean, for lay people, it's like, well, I want to be spiritual. So what does that mean? You know, if you don't feel connected to all beings, then hot flash for you, you're not spiritual. You know, if you think spiritual means, you know, I like colors, you know, I mean, that's, you know, whatever. So for me, I realized that the way I connect, that being the definition, an operating definition of spirituality, the way I get in touch with my spiritual awareness and the way I deepen my spiritual life and the way I move my spiritual growth forward always seems to be when I'm doing some form of service. When I'm serving others, that's when I'm able to see my connection to others. It's when spiritual principles like compassion and generosity, well, I call those spiritual practices actually in another book I wrote called Desperately Seeking Spirituality. Is that what it's called? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so, you know, when I'm with other people, when I'm working on behalf of other people, even if I'm not working directly with other people, let's say I'm just, you know, one of my examples, I think I put this in the book, Deliberate Acts of Kindness, folding blankets in the blanket room at a yoga ashram. You know, in a yoga ashram, you got to know that we're not talking like 25 or 50 blankets. We're talking hundreds of blankets that need to be folded in a particular way so they fit on the shelf. Well, doing that with intentionality becomes a spiritual practice that can go through all the different things, all the different stations that are usually involved with spiritual practice, starting with, look at me, look at how I'm serving, to God, I hate this, and people are pigs, and no, really, I need to come back into loving this, and maybe I can get away with folding this one sloppy. You know, it's like all that, you know, maybe I can cheat on this prayer. I mean, all that stuff shows up in the act of folding blankets. So it's really the, you know, chop wood, carry water, or the Brother Lawrence notion that anything you do with intentionality can become a spiritual practice. So for me, I've realized over time that it really is service for me is where I get the most spiritual growth. And as I wrote this book, surprise, no surprise, I realized that that's very much a part of Judaism, and it's as it is part of all religious traditions, you know, across, you know, Eastern and Western. So with this book in particular, although I've done this in other books, but in this book especially, I do introduce readers to how service as a spiritual practice, how that is found in all religious traditions, and how it shows up as a religious, as a spiritual practice across traditions. Because one of the other things I'm very keen on in my work, and I'm very keen on this in my online presence on Twitter, mostly on Twitter, but also on Facebook, is you know, inviting people to get out of their denominational silos, to get out of their religious, ghettos, and to understand that we really are connected in some profound and important ways. So I'm all about, I think that's a leftover from being a college professor. When that career ended, and it needed to, and that was fine, but I went through a period of mourning that, and then I snapped out of it and realized I don't have to be in front of a classroom to teach. Mm-hmm. My writing so be teaching. So
yeah. Well, yeah, I totally agree with you there. It seems as though this in faith practices and religious practices, the idea of serving others is a way to remove yourself from the center of your worldview and reaching out and becoming less selfish and realizing how, you're right, how interconnected we are, but that the world doesn't have to begin and end with you.
Well, right. And yeah. Well, and it's at the core of, it's what makes 12-step recovery programs intensely spiritual, because that notion of, not notion, that step about serving others, step 12, serving others, and then laced throughout the program and the literature for 12-step recovery is, reach out to others. And part of the, one of the slogans is, if you think, or one of the sayings is, if you think God is your co-pilot, you're in the wrong seat. So there's this whole notion of, you're not it. You know, choose a higher power. Guess what? Not you. So.
Now, as you were writing this, it really is a very practical book with writing exercises through it. And it really takes people through step by step. How do you discern a calling? Which I'd like to ask you a couple questions about that as well. And it works you through, like, how would you determine what you should do for service and volunteering, and takes you all the way through, like, when you actually bump against that wall of not liking it anymore, and then all sorts of things, which is very practical. And who did you exactly have in mind as you were writing this? Was it somebody who was younger who had never experienced service before, or somebody who had just paid no attention to service in their life? Who did you have in mind?
Well, I would not say younger chronologically. In fact, the book that's coming out from Liturgical Press in August is called Transcending Generations, a field guide to collaboration in church. And we really should talk about that field guide thing. But so I've come around to thinking chronological age is probably the least useful variable we could ever have for anything, unless we're talking about age-related cataracts or cognitive problems. But I would say somebody young in their, or new to their spiritual growth, although saying that, I've had people who are fairly experienced or view themselves as longtime spiritual seekers have said, your book is so helpful. I didn't even really think about that stuff. And so that's interesting. So I would say it really does, will appeal to a range of people, people who are new to service, people who haven't thought about service as a spiritual practice per se, people who have been engaged in spiritual practices for a long time, the traditional ones, but don't like them anymore, or don't are thinking and feeling that they're not growing. That praying the rosary or walking a labyrinth or whatever they're doing, or praying the liturgy of the hours or whatever they're doing, is not enhancing their spiritual growth. So, even people who are experienced in practices, I would hope, would look at this book and say, oh, that's another way to think about it. All of my books are very practical. I include a lot of stories about my, I tell on myself a lot. I include a lot of anecdotal information. You don't even have to read that carefully to see that you can get a sense of what I've been doing and have been doing or want to be doing or should have been doing in my life when you read my my work. But, my books, I've never really been called to write a memoir or anything like that because my books are so self-referent. And I use material from my own experience and my own bloopers, spiritual bloopers. I use them in the book. I think my writing is service as a spiritual practice. I really want to help people learn and grow. And so that's why my very first book was a tips book called Tips for Your Home Office. And then they retitled it to Working at Home, Making It Work for You. Now, I wrote that book in the mid-90s. It was my first book. I wrote it in the mid-1990s or early 1990s. And it had all these tips that included things like aromatherapy and lighting and color. And I actually had an organizing business for years and long before decluttering became, a thing. I was talking about it as, clutter being spiritually, contraindicated for spiritual growth. So my very first book was a tips book. And so there's something, I'm realizing as I'm bossy. I just like to boss people around. I like to say, really try this. See if this works better. So, all right, that's my revelation. Are we done now? I gotta go.
This has been like therapy. I'm gonna send you an invoice.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Thank God. Yeah, that's really interesting. But the wanting to share, what you've learned along the way, so that it's not just your own insights, and that it goes further, and that you can hopefully share with others what you've learned along the way. I mean, I think that's wonderful, wonderful gift to be able to give to people.
And here's the spiritual part of that. Okay. So the spiritual practice embedded in that is then me learning and coming to terms with and practicing surrender, letting go with absolutely no expectation anyone's going to take my advice.
Right.
This is like, just because I write it, please buy my book. But, if you don't follow any of my advice, well, maybe at some point it'll become useful. But meanwhile, I had to write this,
Well, maybe you can go over a little bit of what is a call to service, because for some people, that's a little bit of language of religious language. And some people will be like, oh, I thought that was for, like, if you want to be a priest or something, or other people who might think of that language as grandiose or something, or they themselves are not that spiritual, might be just even uncomfortable with that language. But maybe you can go over what is that that you mean about a call to service?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a call to service, I think you're right, may seem a little grandiose and scary, but it's not as grandiose and scary as a call to vocation. I think that's scarier. like I have a vocation, I have a call. Or, in Eastern terms, as I'm discovering my Dharma, So I think, and in fact, in the book, I have, that whole chapter, Discerning the Call, is a chapter that invites people to think about what is that? When do you know you're ready to serve others? When does that feel like a thing you just have to do? I guess boiled down, that call to service is that felt sense of I'm here for a reason. I'm not quite sure what that reason is, but I know it's got to be more than waiting for Amazon Prime week.
Right.
And for people who are interested in spiritual growth and spiritual life, that call is really nagging. You know, it's nagging from whether you want to call it the universe or God. I feel comfortable with God language, which, by the way, I wasn't always. I mean, if you had met me in the 80s, you would not, early 80s, and certainly the 70s, you would not, I would be unrecognizable compared to what I believe and the language I use today in terms of the God language. So, you know, it's that nagging sense from somewhere, both outside and deep within, that I need to be doing something. This is not enough. And I want to distinguish for your listeners, I am not talking about self-loathing or shaming, like I am not enough, which I think is where people get snagged on some of this stuff, that people who are raised in very in religious traditions that are extremely punitive or authoritarian get all that blended. It all gets conflated with you serve God because you are not enough and your salvation is contingent on being of service. And that is not what I'm talking about. It's that there's got to be more. I want to contribute to that. And I feel, you know, I have this felt sense that it involves doing for others what I would like to be done for me, you know, at that core. Is that clear?
Yeah. And I think a lot of people are drawn to doing more, like why people, young people might join military service or volunteer at a hospital or something like that. Yes. A lot of people will sense, I want to be part of something bigger. I know that I can't just go through life just serving myself or just, you know, meeting my own needs, but it would be satisfying to contribute in a larger way. And they'll sense this gnawing call. And, you know, some people are raised just always serving. Their family has always done that. And you know, if they've been in ministry or something, their family's been in ministry, that will seem like a thread through their whole life. But then there's other people who just come to a point in their life where they're like, okay, I'm going to take a different direction and I'm going to invest myself in something. And I think that is very powerful and most people can probably really relate to that.
Another point I would like to make, which is kind of interesting, is that the vectors, the arrows go both ways. So I've also seen it happen where people have been court ordered into service, you know, with creative sentencing, where they have done something and the court has ordered them to serve in a shelter or serve in a food pantry, food bank, or do this or the other. And what's happened as a result, or attend a 12-step, you know, attend NA or NA or AA or whatever, and that's been court ordered. And as a result of doing that, at first with great reluctance and resistance, the person has suddenly understood, oh my, I am not at the center of the universe, and then keeps going. So we, you know, I'm not really, and I think I do mention this in the book. I have that thing as like angels, you know, or is it angels coming down on high or what? You know, I don't think it also, it always has to be somebody struck spiritual and suddenly realizes, oh my God in heaven, I must be this, you know, it can be the most mundane situation where you go to a no-kill animal shelter and suddenly find that you're walking dogs, and that's suddenly you're in service.
Mm. Well, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about the shadow side, because
my favorite chapter.
Because then we all either are or have known someone who is like serving till they're completely burnt. Oh. Or, you know, in church, we'll see the same 15%, 10 or 15% doing in every committee, doing every single thing. And there's the problem of the boundaries and helping too much. And it would be great if you could address that a little bit. I know it's on page 73 in your book, but I think it's really important to address that too, because it can really swing. You go from like not helping at all.
Oh my Lord, I know. And I do hope people, well, I certainly hope people read this book and enjoy it. And then Desperately Seeking Spirituality, I have a whole chapter in there about burnout. I just cannot stop writing about that enough. So the first thing I want to say about that chapter, other than it's my favorite chapter, is that that list of spiritual abuse. Well, if it quacks like a duck, that thing on spiritual abuse, all personal experience. Examples, I have experienced every single one of those, and I'm survived, and I am alive and well, and still writing about it and encouraging others to serve. So, it shows up late in the book, but also in the beginning, in the introduction, in my preface, I tell this story about having to fall down a flight of stairs and sprain my ankle until I realized that actually I am burned out. And that was a period of time where I was doing a lot of hospice work plus supporting people who were having one person in particular was having fairly significant surgery and was doing a lot of hospital monitoring, visiting, and interface with doctors. And I loved the work. It really got me out of myself, and I was exhausted, and I just didn't know it until I fell down a flight of stairs and realized that. I'm a member of the 2x4 club. The Almighty says, all right, clearly you're not getting the small, still voice approach. I'm going to really get your attention. So, self-care is as important, is a critical element of any kind of spiritual practice. And self-care when it comes to spiritual life and spiritual practice means setting up a series of markers and also an account and a system for accountability to others who can help you understand if you're not getting it yourself when you are moving swiftly towards overload. And for every environment where our service is welcomed, there are people within that environment who will exploit people who serve. Either people or the organization itself will be, by its structure, inherently dysfunctional or exploitative. Now, again, loop back. I'm going to wave the sociology flag. One of my areas of expertise and qualification was bureaucracies and formal organizations. So I'm really quite serious when I say the structure of the organization itself may be such that the people are fine, but the organization will lead to some kind of dysfunctional, abusive situation. The church, the institutional church, is just one example of it. And it's a fairly florid example of that because within the church and spiritual communities, intentional spiritual communities, everything is wrapped up in the language of faith and spirituality. So in a business environment, people can be dysfunctional or cruel or whatever, and you can go to HR. In a church environment, maybe you can go to HR, but you're equally likely for that HR person to say, you really need to put this at the foot of the cross and lift it up to God. So there's all this spiritualizing that goes on around the dysfunctionality and spiritual abuse I see in churches. And actually, one of the other things I do is crisis communications. And I only do one of those, a big case. I only work on one of those maybe once every couple of years because they're so horrible and they involve such abuse and such a violation of good faith in every sense of the word, and often involve people who are running their mouths off with the language of service and ministry. So it's, I laugh about that chapter, but it is an important chapter. And I guess I put it at the end because I don't want to be a total buzzkill.
Right.
Like, I encourage you to serve because it'll deepen your spiritual growth. And oh, by the way, you may be gutted along the way. But it's all fodder. It's all fodder for growth.
Yeah, but it's important to know when you're going in, like in terms of a religious community, loyalty is rewarded even at your own expense. And
exactly.
So that's one thing to really watch out for, that you have to know going in what you are able to give ahead of time. I know, like, one of the consummate problems in church circles anyway is like, would you like to be the Sunday school teacher for life? You
know? Like, yeah, right. Well, and I say I work part-time. I was a pastoral associate at a church for 3 years, and my big joke about that is I was part-time, ha, 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 because there's no such thing as a part-time job in the world of church. Yeah, I was part-time. I had a key to everything. I had to show up and open the church, close the church, plunge crap literally out of the toilets. I mean, that had nothing to do with being the manager of communications. So, hey.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And nonprofits function very, very similarly, too. They have to fundraise. There's too few people, too many hats, and everybody's taking on, when they want to, they can't give you a raise, so they give you another job title.
right. And, well, that happens in industry, too. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we'll give you the title, but at least you can say, I happened to find out that the guy next to me with the same title is making more. But and again, it's the language of stewardship. So we spiritualize the language of stewardship. This is the stewardship of resources, and we have minimal resources, financial. So we're, your work, your time is a resource. And as a good steward, you're going to contribute this. This is your contribution to the church. And then if you push back and say, well, I also want to be a good steward of that resource, it's like, what? Wait, we'll decide how much you work. And the problem with it, there's so many problems with it that are more or less obvious. And the most obvious one is the physical consequences of overwork. And it can be everything from just flat out exhaustion to, I noticed people, I link eating disorders. If I see someone who's extraordinarily thin, and I've seen this in religious communities, people who are extraordinarily thin and seem to be, I would guess, and I'm not a psychologist, I'm a sociologist, but seem to be somewhere in the anorexia, bulimia category. I've seen people kind of shoving individual peas around on their plate in the dining chapel with the language that is some kind of spiritual practice. Not eating, fasting is a spiritual practice. And that has gotten worse because they have been pressed into so much service. And so they can control, really, are the peas on their plate. Conversely, when I see any kind of morbid obesity or clinical obesity in a nonprofit situation, and I see a lot of it in the world of church, my question, which I say to myself usually, is who's doing what to you that you have to guard yourself with all that? And it's one of the things we don't, maybe it'll be a book in the future. I mean, it's one of the things we do not talk about enough in the world of church is the levels of addiction and alcoholism that come out of a lack of self-care and a dysfunctional system. And that is part and parcel of the shadow side of service. Calling it out is very difficult for some people, both the people who call it out and the people who are challenged to look at it. A lot of people simply do not want to hear it.
Yeah. And it really starts from the top down. Like I know, like the pastor who is, or the, you know, church leader or ministry leader who is way, way, way overcommitted can't then say to the parishioners, the followers, you know, take care of yourself. Yeah, like it's not like if all the leadership is completely overcommitted and completely overdoing it, that just sets the culture of the whole place exactly. to make sure you're doing as much as we are, and it can be just a place of it can become toxic and
right, and the secrecy around the breakdown. So mm-hmm. when that clergy person collapses, either has some kind of legitimately diagnosable mental breakdown or some kind of psycho-spiritual crisis breakdown and goes back into that dark night of the soul, because the spiritual journey, it's circular. It doesn't, it's a circle. It's not a line. Just because you get like, oh, I found God and now I want to serve others, doesn't mean you're not going to have another wake up call in dark night of the soul. So I think where we really need to do a lot of work in ministry, and those of us who work with ministers, is to say, let's stop with all the secrecy around the breakdowns. So you shuffle clergy off to rehab centers and come up with some crazy story about who knows what, instead of saying, wow, as a result of this, this person had a complete meltdown, is now taking care of himself or herself. What do we need to look at? How might we deal with this as a community so that we can help others not, you know, go through this? And we confuse privacy with secrecy. I see it all the time in church. And when I teach people about digital ministry and how the world has changed because our culture has changed because of digital technology and the speed and the access we have to very personal information, I say to people, please understand that privacy is not the same thing as secrecy. So I would ask you to discern whether you want to keep something private or are you trying to keep something secret? And if it's the latter, guess what? You have some work to do.
That's a really powerful point, because I think a lot of people listening might be already doing service, but sure. Are they being careful about overdoing it? And are they doing it? Sometimes we do service to hide too. Do you
oh,
know?
Sure.
Right?
And, I've done that.
Yeah.
I've done that.
I mean, you know, when you're, because it's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to help other people, but sometimes you're doing it because it keeps you distracted.
And it feels good. I mean, if you're in a service environment, people are saying, good job. And thank you so much. You are a blessing to us. You're a blessing to us. And never says, you're a blessing to us, but I need to tell you that I'm also noticing some of these behaviors, and let's talk about that.
The one thing I love on page 97, I'm going to read it out, and I'm really okay. hoping that people, I love the contemplative writing exercise that you have there.
Yeah.
And it's talking about returning to center. This is when you're avoiding burnout, you're coming back from burnout. And I thought this was fantastic. I hope that people pick up your book and go through these writing exercises, especially if they're feeling burned out or if they're looking for where should I, where's the best place to plug into to do service. But this writing exercise says, now you're really confused. What you thought was true is false. What you believed was right is wrong. What you hoped was light is dark. It's time to return to center by doing a bit of contemplative writing in response to these questions. And then there's five questions. They are, what did I initially feel called to do? In what ways has my participation answered that calling? How, if at all, has my calling changed? What am I now called to do or be? Where am I now called to serve? A kind of reevaluation of those things. I think it's important to think about reevaluation, and that you don't have to just trudge on through if things aren't going well, if you're not taking care of yourself, if there's abuse or something like that going on.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you so much. First of all, thank you for reading that. It's interesting to hear someone read it. You know, when I proofread galleys, I read them out loud to help me find, you know, anything that needs to be corrected. When I write, sometimes I read out loud. But to have someone, thank you. It's just really kind of cool to hear you read that. The contemplative writing exercises in this book, especially in this book, someone who I gave this book to a friend of mine who actually is fairly young chronologically, but a very has longtime experience in service and spiritual communities. And he said to me, I'm doing the contemplative writing exercises. And I was like, you are? He goes, yeah, I'm really learning a lot. And I'm like, you are? Cool. You know, it's like, so those exercises, again, I just want listeners to know, I actually do these things. These are not things I boost from someone else. I do get inspired by other, I don't think there's a writer on the planet who writes stuff like this who hasn't been inspired by Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way. I mean, her books, her exercises are a stellar example of how to write these sorts of exercises. But all the contemplative writing exercises are ones that I work through myself and that I've tried. I'm my own guinea pig because, and I, you know, ironically, is I'll get myself in all sorts of trouble. And then, you know, like after this conversation, I'll probably have to go back and do that writing exercise.
Right, sure, sure.
But, yeah, all my books have them. All my books have them. And I think, you know, part of it is, just having been an educator for so long, you know, helping people think through. I'm also big, very big on the Socratic method, you know, asking people to, you know, think through, dive in, respond, design thinking in the world of, you know, tech and design thinking. The language for that is how might we do? How might we create? And I've worked in and around healthcare for a really long time as well, and I picked that up through my healthcare colleagues who were doing design thinking exercises around reconstructing healthcare delivery and involving patients. And that went deep for me. How might we? So you can tell when I started to get active with that because I've started to use a lot of that language in my books.
Yeah. It's one thing to just ingest a lot of material that's useful. It's a whole other thing to allow it to transform you by asking yourself your own hard questions. And I think that's where it starts to become powerful and starts to move in your interior world that it might actually change your life and there might be these outcomes that happen.
Yeah. And again, it's interesting in 12-step recovery programs, and I'm big on that. I'm mentioning that a lot for a couple of reasons. One is I do have a tips book called Staying Sober, which has been around for a long time and is evergreen and seems to be experiencing a renaissance since my agent and I persuaded Hazelden to put it in e-format. But the other reason is because I'm currently working on a book about the spiritual wisdom and 12-step slogans. So it's really on my mind about that. So looping back to, so in 12-step recovery, you find that in the whole notion of the fourth step, like all these questions, going back and doing a rigorously honest personal inventory. What have I done? What have I made up about what I've done? What was it really about? You know, really very deep self-searching. And again, in every religious tradition, there's something that looks like confession. It may not be called confession, but there's something that involves soul searching with God or with another and or with another person to say, what am I doing? What have I done? What do I want to do differently? I actually went through the church, a Roman Catholic Church's annulment process, and people looked at me and said, are you crazy? first of all, you're not Catholic. I wasn't Catholic at the time, but I just, and people often ask me if I'm crazy. I actually don't get offended by it. I don't feel like they're name calling or labeling me because actually it's probably true. But I got to be me. So I actually went through that annulment process. And what was so interesting is that I had already been through a lot of, done a lot of spiritual work. So I treated the church's questionnaire as an opportunity, like a contemplative writing exercise. And as a result of doing that, I was able to see the patterns that I had recreated from my family of origin. And, you know, no one could ever accuse the Roman Catholic Church of being particularly therapeutic. But this thing was. And to the point where the chancellor of the diocese called me in, she was also the canon lawyer, you know, the judge on my case. She called me in and she said, I wanted to meet you because I don't think I've ever read an annulment petition like yours. You took this very seriously. I said, yes, I did. And I learned a lot about myself. And if you ever want me to go with you to talk to people who are treating the annulment process as just more junk and ridiculousness coming out of the church, I'm happy to talk about how to transform that into something that has spiritual value. And she took me up on that. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is fascinating because all these big moments in our lives, the departures and the arrivals and the thresholds that we cross are these big marking periods. And if we don't take them seriously, we don't grow and learn from them or leave things behind that we should leave behind. I think it's really pivotal in our lives to know where we came from.
Yeah, agree.
Well, this has been very powerful, and I'm so fortunate, so glad that you would come on my show. Is there any way that people can best reach you?
Oh, just go online. Just type my name. I am the easiest person on the planet to find if you Google me. Although I am not the gymnast nor the Meredith Gould who was a beauty queen anywhere, really. I think some beauty queen in the Midwest has my name, and I really need to talk to her about trademark violation. But if you type in Meredith Gould and all my social media accounts and my website, I use my name on it. So meredithgould.com has all the information about my consulting and also my editorial services. And on the author page, people can easily click through to order books. And I really ask people to do that because I do have an Amazon Associates account, and I put on that page, help me put cat food on the floor. You know, I think I make like 50 cents every time somebody clicks through, but that's okay. I'm on Twitter. I'm very, Twitter is really where I do most of what I call digital ministry. I'm on it all the time for a bunch of reasons. I talk to people in public. I talk to people through the back channel. I spend a lot of time with clergy who are very upset about the way the world is going, the world of church is going. I have an author page on Facebook and a profile on Facebook, and people can follow me on both. More fun stuff on the profile, more authory writing stuff on the author page, shock. And I have an Instagram account. Now, my Instagram account is called The Meredith Gould because some poseur already had Meredith Gould.
The nerve.
I know. It better not be that beauty, that adolescent beauty queen. But anyway, yes. Yeah, so The Meredith Gould. And I, Instagram is my happy place. And I love that social media platform because that reinvited me back into the world of color and art in a way I haven't been before. Mm-hmm. So
that's good. Do you have any last words of wisdom?
Serve wisely, serve well, serve carefully, and you know, take care of yourself as you take care of others, or provide care for others. Actually, I don't like the word taking care of others. I've never liked the word caretaker. I'm glad when we shifted it to caregiver. We give care and we receive care optimally. And if my book helps people do that in a healthier way, then I'm thrilled.
Great. So that's Deliberate Acts of Kindness, a field guide to service as a spiritual practice. Thank you so much, Meredith. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.